Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we are talking about a topic that absolutely fascinates me: beauty in the Middle Ages. Beauty ideals, cosmetics, and personal care in an era we often imagine quite differently from how it actually was.
That's true. When people think of the Middle Ages, they usually picture dirty streets, unwashed people, the typical cliché. But was it really like that?
Not at all. People back then had a very keen sense of aesthetics and personal care, just by completely different standards than we have today. And that's exactly what makes it so fascinating. We can learn a lot about a culture by looking at its beauty ideals.
That's the point. What's considered attractive today, and I have to just briefly
think about what that even is.
Yes. So today we have these, how should I put it, very defined and media-driven standards. Fitness bodies, certain proportions, flawless skin, full lips. The idea keeps shifting constantly.
20 years ago, completely different body shapes were in vogue than today. In the 90s, extreme thinness was the ideal. Today, curves are back in demand. That shows how culturally shaped it all is.
And in the Middle Ages, things looked completely different again. Especially in the 14th and 15th centuries, women aspired to a girlish, slender ideal. Small breasts and pronounced hips. You can see this beautifully in the art of that period.
There was a very practical reason behind this. Wide hips and an emphasized pelvis were associated with fertility, signaling the ability to bear children and good health. Small breasts and pale skin, on the other hand, were seen as signs of youthfulness and purity. In an era of high infant mortality, such ideals were deeply rooted in society.
And you know what I find particularly fascinating? The high forehead as a beauty ideal. It was so important that women sometimes went to enormous lengths to achieve it.
Oh, yes. They actually shaved or plucked at the beauty.
Yes, the forehead is intense and particularly machen. It was so important that women sometimes went to enormous lengths to achieve it.
Oh, yes. They actually shaved or plucked at the beauty. Sometimes even their eyebrows too.
Today, people would more likely try to hide a high forehead with bangs. Back then, it was the ultimate beauty ideal. The higher, the better.
For men, by the way, it was also completely different from what you'd expect. Slender waist, youthful appearance. Knights were often depicted in art with long, flowing hair and
feminine features, soft facial features, almost androgynous in some cases.
So completely different from that burly, bearded warrior image we know from films and TV series today. In the High Middle Ages, especially in courtly culture, nobles were often clean-shaven, but that really varied depending on the time and region.
This shows that beauty is never objective. What's considered attractive is always a reflection of the time and culture. Every era has its own ideals.
And that's exactly what we're exploring today. We're not only looking at what was considered beautiful, but also quite specifically, how did people back then try to live up to these expectations?
Cosmetics, hair care, hygiene, it all existed. And some of it might surprise you. Medieval people were much more creative and hygiene conscious than we often think.
I'm looking forward to it. So, let's dive together into the fascinating world of medieval beauty care.
You mentioned earlier the ideal of small breasts and pronounced hips. Let's take a closer look at that, because these features weren't just an aesthetic matter, but also a deeply symbolic one that varied slightly by region and time.
Exactly. It wasn't just about an abstract beauty ideal, but about a direct promise of offspring. In an era when political alliances were secured through lines of succession, this signaled fertility was absolutely essential.
This statement, as you call it, was almost a form of political capital. The ability to bear children was a visible sign of status and power, especially among the nobility.
What's interesting is that these ideals also varied by region. Burgundy and Italy had somewhat different emphases than, say, England or the German territories. But certain fundamentals, like the emphasis on fertility markers, ran throughout all of Europe.
And that brings us back to what you briefly touched on earlier, the high
forehead. Let's dig deeper into that, because the background is truly astonishing.
And it wasn't just some trend. Especially in the 15th century, among the Burgundian and Italian upper classes, the high forehead was a true beauty ideal. In art, it symbolized purity and wisdom, essentially a visible sign of inner virtue.
And this practice you've already described, shaving or plucking with tweezers or blades, is clearly visible in the art of the period. In portraits by Rogier van der Weyden or Petrus Christus, for example, these high hairlines really stand out.
A famous example from art is Simonetta Vespucci, Botticelli's muse. If you look at her portraits, that high, clear forehead, the golden hair. Whether she personally plucked her hairline, we don't know. But Botticelli immortalized her as the ideal of her time.
What really makes me think about this is the effort involved. It wasn't just a one-time plucking. Hair grows back. And there were recipes intended to prevent regrowth. Some of them sound quite adventurous.
You mean these, how should I put it, folk remedy mixtures?
Among others, there are preserved recipes, from the Trotula, for example, with ingredients like bat's blood or even dog's milk. More common, though, were mixtures containing quickite, lye, or arsenic preparations. How effective all of this actually was is questionable, of course, but it shows how far women were willing to go.
And of course, this wasn't without risk. Infections from small wounds, skin irritation, that certainly happened. After all, antibiotics didn't exist.
What I notice in living history portrayals, these details are often overlooked. People think about dresses and jewelry, but such body modifications, they should really be part of an authentic representation of an era.
That's true. And it also shows that the pressure to conform to beauty ideals isn't a modern invention. The methods were different, but the motivation
was the same. Recognition, status, social belonging.
Exactly. And when you consider that, it also puts our view of today into perspective. The ideals change, but the human need to conform to them remains.
Which is somehow reassuring. We're not the first to deal with such expectations, and we won't be the last. This social pressure didn't just apply to women, though. There were beauty ideals for men, too, which often had little to do with our modern conceptions.
We briefly touched on the almost androgynous features of knights in art earlier. This ideal of a slender body with soft facial features and long hair was quite a stark contrast to the pure, rough warrior image.
The courtly ideal played a major role there. The knight as a minnesinger, as a cultured lover. In troubadour culture, the refined man was the ideal, not the brutish fighter. It was a completely different notion of masculinity.
Over the course of the Middle Ages, that changed, though. Shorter hairstyles came into fashion, and
being clean-shaven became popular, especially in the later Middle Ages.
Although that also depended on social class. Among peasants, shorter hair was common,
but less as a status symbol, more for practical reasons. Hair length depended heavily on fashion and work situation.
For women, it was different. Long, flowing hair was the ideal, but completely impractical in daily life. Imagine working in the fields or at the loom with loose hair down to your hips.
A nightmare.
That's why women wore braids, plaited hairstyles, hairnets, and of course, hair accessories. Circlets, ribbons, pearls. Loose hair was often a sign of being unmarried. It appeared at weddings or festivals, but in everyday life it was usually bound or covered.
And then there's the matter of hair color. Blonde was the beauty ideal.
And that had deep symbolic roots. Blonde hair was associated with light, with sunbeams, with gold. In art, saints and the Virgin Mary were often depicted as blonde. It was seen as a sign of purity and virtue.
By the way, this wasn't a purely medieval invention. Even in antiquity, blonde hair was coveted. The Romans even imported wigs made from Germanic hair.
And in the Middle Ages, women dyed their hair to match this ideal. Saffron, chamomile, sulfur for bleaching, sitting in the sun for hours with special mixtures.
Saffron! That was incredibly expensive.
Extremely. Only the upper class could afford that. The dyeing process was an enormous undertaking. The mixture had to sit for hours, sometimes over several days. Then it was set with egg white. A true luxury.
So even back then, beauty cost time and money.
The church viewed this critically, by the way. Hair dyeing was considered tampering with God's creation. But that didn't stop women. At least those who could afford it.
And curls? Those were popular too, weren't they?
Oh yes. Curls were absolutely en vogue. There were special techniques for this. Hair was actually treated with curling irons, so, what's the term? An early curling wand. By the way, this was used by women, men, and even clergy. Alternatively, wet hair was wrapped with cords. Egg white was used as a setting agent. It provided hold and shine.
So basically the predecessors of our styling products.
You could see it that way. The desire to shape and beautify one's own hair is truly universal. Only the tools have changed.
What I find fascinating about this, for living history portrayals, this is an important aspect. Authentic hairstyles make a big difference when you want to convincingly represent an era.
Absolutely. And some of these old techniques actually still work. Chamomile for lightening. People still use that today. I just wouldn't recommend sulfur.
Now we come to a topic loaded with prejudices. Cosmetics and hygiene in the Middle Ages. And I deliberately say prejudices, because the image of the dirty, unwashed Middle Ages is, how should I put it, largely a myth.
That's right. This myth largely originated during the Enlightenment of the 18th century and was then reinforced in the 19th century when people liked to distance themselves from the supposedly dark past. The actual sources tell a different story.
And one of the most important sources is the so-called Trotula. It's a collection of three medical texts created in the 12th century at the Scola Medica Salernitana, one of the first major medical schools in Western Europe.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Southern Italy, a true center of knowledge. And remarkably, part of these texts is traditionally attributed to a female physician, Trotta of Salerno, whose existence has now been confirmed through manuscript discoveries, including in Madrid, in the 12th century.
The work was translated into at least 8 languages and remained a standard reference until the 16th century.
And it contains very specific recipes for makeup, for sun protection, for
lip care. So a complete cosmetic routine, if you will.
Foundations were made from wheat starch and rose water. This created a light, even complexion. A beauty ideal then as now. The mixture was gentle on the skin and applied easily.
For the lips, for example, a pomade made from Brazil wood was used, which gave them a soft, reddish tint.
That's essentially the same principle we know today from tinted lip balms.
Some of these basic recipes actually still work, by the way. Rose water as a facial toner is totally popular again today, and wheat starch is still used in some natural cosmetic products.
What fascinates me especially are the perfumes. They weren't just a luxury, but also served a practical purpose.
The scented waters, rose water, lavender water, were used both for the body and for rooms. Caps were fitted with scented cushions. People wanted to smell good, and they had the means to do so.
And then there's hygiene itself. There were herbal mouthwashes, toothpicks made of bone, chewing sticks made of wood, tooth powders. And people rubbed their teeth with cloths and herbs. Bristle toothbrushes only came to Europe from China in the 18th century. It might sound unusual to us, but it shows. Dental care was a concern.
Yeah, and that completely contradicts this image of people with rotten teeth who never did anything for their dental care in their lives.
Soap existed too. It wasn't as widespread as today, but it was available. Especially in towns with soap makers, it was quite accessible, though expensive.
What impressed me in my research are these hygiene kits. They were worn on the belt and contained ear scoops, nail cleaners, sometimes even small tweezers. Almost like a
medieval grooming kit.
That's a good way to put it. And such sets are found relatively frequently in archaeological digs. These weren't just one-off pieces for nobility, but were also common among wealthier townspeople and craftsmen.
This shows that personal care wasn't just a matter of luxury, but part of everyday life. People had an awareness of cleanliness and aesthetics.
Which doesn't mean everything was perfect, of course. Standards were different from today, possibilities more limited. But this cliché of the smelly, filthy Middle Ages, it simply doesn't hold up.
And by the way, the Trotula also recommended a balanced diet and physical activity, especially for women's health. It even linked menstrual disorders to malnutrition or stress. That sounds surprisingly modern, doesn't it?
Some things never change. A healthy lifestyle, personal care, a bit of cosmetics. The need to take care of oneself and look good is truly timeless. When I think back now on everything we've discussed, beauty care in the Middle Ages was really astonishingly diverse. It was never just about vanity.
Aesthetics and health were closely intertwined. The Trotula wasn't a medical work for nothing. Personal care was understood as part of a healthy life.
And yes, some practices seem strange to us today. Shaving your forehead for a higher hairline, or bleaching your hair for hours with sulfur. That sounds extreme.
But you know what? In 500 years, people will probably shake their heads just the same at what we do today. Botox, lip fillers, Brazilian waxing,
microblading, teeth whitening, 12-step skincare routines.
Exactly. The methods change, but the fundamental need remains. The desire to be beautiful and well-groomed. That's deeply ingrained in us, across all eras.
And I actually find that comforting. It connects us with the people who came before us. We're not that different after all.
The medieval woman caring for her face with rose water and the modern woman with her moisturizer, at their core, it's about the same thing, about self-care, about feeling comfortable in your own skin.
And that's perhaps the most important insight from all of this. Beauty ideals are fleeting.
Absolutely. But the human need behind them is truly timeless.
Well said. That's it for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed this journey into the medieval world of beauty.
If you found this topic interesting, feel free to check out battlemerchant.com. And on the blog, you'll find many more fascinating articles on the history and culture of past eras.
Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.